back at it, craftmatic. All I know is mathematics. On the stove, cooking chicken, right me, Gigi gymnastic. Acrobatic with the work. Like who did it, do the magic? Me go bring me kilo, so I Well, welcome everybody. My name is David of Browntown.
I am Colin of Browntown.
And we are here presenting to you Bourbon in Browntown.
Yes, yes.
Colin, what are we drinking today?
Today we are drinking Serpent's Bite Apple Cider Flavored Whiskey. I am aware that it is not technically bourbon, but I got this from Strack and Van Til, a grocery store that is actually closing. It's not Elston in Chicago. It's closing down soon, so I got it for super cheap. $8, 50% off, which is great. So again, this is Colin David of Browntown. You ask, what is Browntown? Well, I am a Negro. I'm black. You can't see us. David is Mexican. Our third roommate, who works a normal job at KPMG, his name is Nabil. He is Pakistani. So we are all different types of brown, if you will. So we decided to call our apartment Browntown.
That's love
pretty,
it.
Pretty much all it is to it. So we, you know, with alliteration, Bourbon Browntown came about. I think David thought of it. I'll give him props for that. In future installments, we may not always have bourbon necessarily. Technically, this is even bourbon we have today, but we got it for the low. So,
and so today's episode is black and brown representation in media, you know, and Atlanta being one of these newest hot shows out there. They got signed for season 2 and 3, I think, or is it just 2?
Probably just 2, but I mean, it'll go for a little bit.
And so what you guys just heard at the beginning of this podcast would be the intro to Atlanta, which is on FX. No hooks from Mr. OJ, the Juice Man himself.
Duh, Juice Man.
The whole soundtrack on Atlanta is absolutely dope as fuck. The whole track bangs hard throughout, and it really does complement the episodes or particular scenes for each individual, and It's absolutely wonderful. Have you seen Atlanta, Colin?
It's phenomenal. Let's get the folks what Atlanta is, what is in general, what it's about.
Yeah, so for anyone who hasn't seen it, Atlanta would be a show about a character, Donald Glover's character, whose name is...
Ernest.
Ernest Hemingway, no, Ernest. And so he goes back home, tries to run into his cousin, who is currently going by Paperboy.
All about the paper boy.
And he's a rapper, and he tries to get in with his cousin, and eventually they're just trying to make it big. For anyone who hasn't seen the show, we might give off some things, but this is all in the first hour. So he ends up going to jail because him and his cousin end up shooting somebody. It's an interesting showing of these people inside of jail, all of who are primarily of color, in the jail cell, except for the head police officer, who happens to be a white guy. And you want to tell us a little what you saw in that scene?
Yeah, a little bit. So the show in general is a very character-driven, nuanced look at a lot of different things. It presents issues in a way that very natural, but also very critical at the same time. So, for example, when Don Glover's in jail, there's this scene that really isn't that long, maybe it's a couple minutes. You get to experience its look on trans people. Let's look on kind of general mental health. It's a good analysis on racialized incarceration, since all these men are in urban community in Atlanta and they're all black men, right? It's one of the interactions that's really funny, but also really, like, again, it's really brilliant at the same time. It's Donald Glover really in between this dude and this trans woman, and they're talking back and forth, and the guy's talking about how they used to date and used to be, you know, sexually involved. And then everyone else kind of making fun of him, calling him gay, because she appears like a man. And Donald Glover kind of gets vilified for being in the middle of it for no reason by the guy, who's very aggressive. But one of the things that Donald Glover says, which is really funny with the tonality of the scene, but also very true, he's kind of like, well, like, sexuality is a landscape. You can kind of do whatever you want. Like, it's not a big deal. But all these guys are, you know, vilifying this dude for being gay. And it's funny, but you feel very implicated at the same time. You're laughing at this, and you feel like you shouldn't be, but also it's looking at, you know,
the landscape,
the landscape, which is, again, kind of in the conversation now, right? So I kind of preach really with everything I ever talk about. It's like a lot of the issues that we talk about now: mass racialized incarceration, war on drugs, economic justice, gay rights, trans rights, black pride. All these things are, like, we're talking about them now, right? And we have this mobilization of groups and of celebrities, what have you, talking about these things. These things didn't disappear overnight. Like, one thing I always talk about with police brutality and police killings is, like, Black folks have been being killed by police for a minute now, right? But we're mad about it now. It's in this conversation now. White folks know about it now, and that wasn't the case like 10 years ago. So trans rights and trans people existing and using bathrooms, they've been doing it for a while, and everything's been fine. But we're mad about it now, and there's legislation about it now, and, you know, whatever. So this is kind of one of those things that's been around for a while. But Atlanta does a great job of pairing these, you know, macro-level issues with the time that we live in now, and also with this nuanced look and this how it operates through the eyes of Earn, our main character. So it's very, very layered.
No, and how I had spoken about Atlanta season premiere, it was broken up in two parts. The second part, Earn is basically in jail for the whole scene, waiting for someone to come get him out. Mm. And in that, we see him have that interaction with the trans person as well as the dude who was with her and what have you. And you're right, it was funny, and it's kind of like, oh, I'm not supposed to be laughing, but it's like, you know, it was interesting. And so in that same sort of scene, you're also exposed to the gentleman, as you were talking about, with mental health.
Right.
And we get an example of how mental health issues aren't taken as seriously in these black and brown communities. And I think Atlanta is able to highlight that in a very, very dynamic but very simple sort of way.
Yeah, so a lot of things are happening during that scene that are, you know, really late and really kind of looking at these macro issues. One of the ones, like you mentioned, with the dude spouting out, like, he has water in his mouth and he kind of like spits it out to people, or spits it out like he acts like he's like a duck or some kind of animal or something, and everyone's laughing at him, and he's in like a medical, like a smock or something, and he's kind of really being really goofy, but he's clearly got like some mental issues going on, and everyone in the holding kind of like laughing at him, and they mention that he's there every week, and everyone's kind of like just very much normalizing the behavior, normalizing this dude, and Donald Glover's character Earn is just kind of like, what, like, why is he here every week, like, he needs help.
Yeah.
So he was like, the audience is kind of speaking through him, like, question, like, what the hell is going on? Why is this dude doing this? You know, looking at mental health issues and kind of like not funding them, and or used to be funding them and closing them down, and just like not really giving them the resources they need. And then what happens on top of that is the guy finally spits some water at the white police officer, who I think is the only white person in the room, or maybe the episode. And he beats him down. He beats his ass. He
beat his ass
immediately. And everyone kind of jumps at first, and they're kind of like, all right, well, that happened, and let's move on. And like that is like another kind of argument for, you know, police brutality. But I think even deeper than just police brutality of an oppressive white say on black people, but also it's like this guy has mental health issues, who the police officer didn't know how to deal with other than by a punitive measure. I forgot the name of the exact incident. But there's an incident in Chicago recently where a young black man was going through an episode of some mental health difficulties that he was having, and the police officer didn't know how to deal with it and took it as aggressive and killed him. He's no longer with us because the police officer wasn't trained in order to how to deal with his issues. And this was a microcosm for the same thing. Obviously, they filmed and scripted this before that happened, but, you know, the story I'm talking about is an anecdote for what happens a lot, right? Mm-hmm. That people aren't trained to deal with mental health issues, and people who have, you know, the power to take lives, to legally take lives and be okay. And the fact that these are happening and they're getting off, everything's fine afterwards, is super problematic and not okay. And this, you know, very brief scene, this broader episode, this broader show is explaining this in a very simple kind of cut and dry way. But also through the eyes of Earn, it gives you a different insight. But you need the eyes of Earn to look at it rationally and look at how it's problematic, how it's not okay. Mm-hmm. But also you need the eyes of everyone else around that in the room with Earn, who's like, oh man, that just happened, and normalize it right away. So a lot of things that we see today and have always seen are normalized, but they're not normal. That pilot episode, that first episode, and that scene specifically just talks about so many different things, but in a way that's nuanced and entertaining and funny, but also makes you really kind of grapple with lots of these issues of our day and of not just of our day now, but of, you know, been issues for years and years, but we're talking about them now. I think that's part of why this show is so special.
No, and it's awesome. Like, I remember the other episode that we had talked about, the Juneteenth or what have you, where Fern and his girlfriend are invited to a sort of a work party for her, if I remember correctly, and they go to this house and they find this, I don't know, flamboyant white man who really loves his black people.
Yes, he's a fan of the blacks, as our president said.
Which is hilarious because so Fern goes into one of the rooms and where there's a lot of African items or artifacts.
Just a lot of African shit. Not shit, like it's great shit. I'm just things of Africa.
Oh, but do you actually? So you want to tell them what I guess, not to go too much in detail, so we don't spoil it for too many people. But what that episode is about and why it kind of spoke to you?
Yeah, the episode is about this party, the Juneteenth party, which is really a party celebration of slavery ending, quote unquote, right?
it's ended, so right?
It's ended. Black people, like, it's, just rewinding on that. Like, I didn't know Juneteenth was like a thing. Until like I was like in college,
really,
which I feel like weird to say, but like I think I heard about it like in high school and a little before that, but I didn't like know, I didn't like study it or any means.
Yeah,
and I was like I was woke as shit in high school. Like I started reading Malcolm when I was like 13, so like I knew my shit, but I never heard about Juneteenth, right? but the great thing about this scene and this episode in general is it's looking at, you know, looking at black folks not as a monolith, but it's looking at this class disparity, mm-hmm. And this as the idea of the black bourgeoisie. And how they kind of look down upon, you know, low-income black Americans, right? And so one of the interesting things at the very end of the episode, I'm going to kind of ruin it for you, but you're going to be fine, is so Ern is there the whole time really kind of making fun of these people as he's interacting with them with his girlfriend. And at the end, very interesting is that the, not the busboys.
No, the valet kids.
The valets outside are just some dudes from Atlanta, dudes from like inner city Atlanta, and they're like, "Oh, yo, Ern, you're the manager for Paperboy, woo, woo." So they recognize him as the manager for this rapper. It's not just like not like Ludacris, but this up and coming, you know, street rapper.
Yeah.
And so they kind of shoo him away, but essentially, like the people that recognize him as this up and coming rapper are the guys, the valet, the work, the help.
Yeah.
The help for other black folks, right? So it's just, you know, breaking down the class-based distinctions of black people. So they notice him. His girlfriend's mentor is like, "Oh, who are those guys?" And then like, "Oh, you manage rap."
Yeah, like a...
When someone says that, you know it's all downhill from there. But they're like, "Oh, you manage rap. Like, you delve in that art form." So like, "Oh, like, we all have, like, some, like, wild-ass cousins, some cousins, you know, ignorant cousins, whatever." So like, you know, I'm pretty much saying, like, okay, it's okay that you do that because, like, he's your family, you're taking care of your family, but you're operating this world that I don't approve of, and me speaking for the black bourgeoisie. Right. And so there's a, you know, conflict there and it kind of blows up and then, you know, things go awry. But it's very interesting as far as how they dissect class within a black space. I think it's a phenomenal episode. And it takes place within the entire party. So, you know, with commercials, it's probably 22, 23 minutes, but it's really a great dissection. And again, it's very nuanced, but you can kind of like, you can hear it in Ern's voice, how he's kind of like, you know, taking jabs at lots of these people, they don't even realize it because he's a very, you know, intelligent individual.
Yeah, no. And I know I'm definitely looking forward to season two and seeing what the whole team has for us. And I think something that you had mentioned is, you know, there's these very comedic moments that sometimes go unnoticed unless, you know, you're really paying attention with not Paperboy, but...
Oh, this is Buddy.
The Buddy, he's like... "I gave you a cookie, remember?" Like, who is this guy? Is he your manager? He said, "No, I don't need to manage." You know, I think his character is very much, you know, at first purely comic relief. And then I love the way each character has its own little episode and is able to grow. And it's something that makes a good television show. You know, you have good writing and good casting and the music bangs.
It bangs hard.
I know it is. There is a playlist on Spotify that I found. So y'all should check it out if you're into it. But continuing on that note with, you know, comedy, with the political sphere that we've kind of been having over the last few months, really, you know, you were saying a lot of these groups, a lot of these organizations are kind of, you know, becoming a little bit more involved. And I really feel that comedy has had its moments with it as well. And so it's interesting seeing now comedy, its use of satire and how that really has a stronger influence over, you know, our generation that really, you know, isn't into news or reads the newspaper. You know, and one of the shows that I was really thinking about was The Daily Show. You know, I think I remember watching it, or I think you were watching it back when we lived on Halsted. And I was just like, I had kind of always known about it. I knew that it existed, and I knew who Jon Stewart was. So I seen him in Big Daddy. but, you know, the way he was able to speak about, you know, a lot of the Bush administration and some of the Obama administration, and, you know, it drew me in as someone who didn't really like politics at the moment and didn't really care about it because, like, oh, I can't really do shit. It's just a bunch of old people playing a game that I have no control over. And kind of him putting it in simpler terms, but yet keeping my attention, and not just myself. And I'm sure plenty of people like have caught onto the show with that in mind. And so when it ended up switching out that Jon Stewart left, I was actually pretty sad. I was like, I've only, you know, seen you for a couple months, but here you are leaving. And then just Trevor was coming in, and I didn't know who Trevor was. And I did know that he did comedy at some point. He was from South Africa, but I really think that the way he's managed the show now, speaking of, you know, black representation in media, it's been great. And I think its influence has been noticed. I watched a Vox video speaking on the same subject of comedy as satire, but they didn't mention them. It was a little interesting.
If you look past the jokes and sight gags, these comedians are doing a really good job of covering Trump, sometimes better than serious news networks.
Nice misdirection, Chris Angel, but you can't just shake your keys and distract us. We're not cable news, we're Americans.
And that's because political satire has something that TV news lacks: a really low tolerance for bullshit.
So the Vox had this video, comedians have figured out a way to cover Trump. And so it's talking about satire, it's talking about comedy, but it fails to bring Trevor into image or into sound. And so, like, it's kind of sad, made me sad.
Yeah, I think the point he's making, the kind of his thesis argument, is great. I think it's brilliant. And that's all the reason I will watch Trevor Noah or, like, just other things like that, because it's like, it's short, it's fast, I don't have time to watch, you know, Andrew Cooper for 2 hours, but I can watch something else for a short and kind of get, I can laugh, and I can also see what the news of the day is. But it's like, yeah, mainstream media, whatever argument we want to say, which I've made sometimes too, about how, like, progressive, how diverse we're getting in 2017, this and the other, it's like, we can still talk about this entire subject of, you know, satirical late night news comedy when The Daily Show's been around since, what, 97? And it's like, this is like a staple, it's a staple Comedy Central show. And you can't bring in Trevor Noah.
Like, you
and
bring
I'm all about Samantha Bee. I've seen her a couple times. She's funny. She makes good points. Her analysis is typically on point. But it's like, she's been around for like a couple months or
yep.
so.
And
Trevor Noah has been around for longer, but not just himself. But he's part of this.
A year now at this point.
It's been a little over a year, yeah. But he's part of this show, which is really a staple of Comedy Central. I think of their first like newsy type program, right? And so he, I won't say started or initiated that format of programming. Maybe I don't know. But the fact that they don't even mention him in that conversation is very interesting. It's very interesting. I mean, I'll back up. It's not interesting because they're cutting out the black man. Like, I'm curious to see if it was Jon Stewart, it would be the same. And sure, Jon Stewart would have tenure and have like over a decade of doing it. But Trevor Noah's doing the same thing. You know, you can do worse, better. You can. That's the debate you can have yourself. But they don't include him in the conversation. It's just kind of like you're forgetting something. And I don't want to skip ahead too much, but it's just like, with the Oscar fiasco and the best picture given to La La Land, and sorry, no, it's Moonlight, woo woo. And like, yeah, it was a mistake, and they kind of fixed it, and like, we kind of know why now. It's just like, the fact that happened, especially this year, of all these black movies doing so well, I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's a microcosm for how the white mainstream sees black art and black space. Even in 2017, even, you know, Trump aside, even in this era where we're more progressive, more diverse, and we understand, you know, all this stuff, and people are more quote-unquote woke and all this bullshit. It's like, no, so we still operate in a mainstream white space, and this is what happens, and these things aren't accidents.
No, and I would agree wholeheartedly. Interestingly enough, you know, for going to the Oscars, though, we do see a constant lack of diversity, and not just with blacks. Where are the Asians? Where are the, you know, the Latinos? You know, it's disheartening at times when you know that Denzel Washington is going up against four other people and he's going to lose to someone like Casey Affleck. It's always on my mind. But I mean, speaking on a more positive note, with Moonlight, you know, it did end up winning Best Picture. It ended up winning Best Adapted Screenplay. Your boy Ali won Best Supporting Actor. And then also, not to forget, Naomi Harris was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, to which she lost to Viola Davis from Fences. And so
we had black women beating out other black women for the same award.
Hey,
I can watch Get Out or Moonlight or Fences, or, you know, I don't have to pick one. Another thing I kind of want to say, just general idea of diversity we think of and like 80s, and we still kind of use it now, multiculturalism, is like people center right have make this argument of like, you know, forcing diversity and forcing this and forcing that. And like, why do we have to force diversity and force? Like, it's something like liberals just want to like say and do just to like feel better about themselves, which I think like white liberals do, but that's a different argument. With those terms, it's like this isn't something we're forcing. This is how our social world looks and operates, right? So when the nominations are going to all white people, or are we looking at something else, like sports, something that's like very much democratic in theory, but it's all white people, all people, one race. It's like, we're not forcing black people in or forcing Latinos in there. It's very much like, this is how our social world looks. And so to deny it of that representation isn't looking at the truth. It's looking at something that's not how our world looks. It's not reality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the problem with whitewashing in general. You know, like, just what was that film we were talking about? The
Exodus, Gods and Kings.
Egypt. It's like, y'all are all from Egypt, but you're all white people.
It's in Africa.
How does that work?
I know they're light skinned, but it's in Africa.
It's like, Sway, what's going on? No, but like, for real, and it just doesn't happen. It's not like it happened just like, oh, it just happened one time. It's like, no, this happens on a constant basis.
Right.
It's like, how? Why? Like, there's plenty of brown and black people around who play the same roles just as well as anybody else. Like, why? What? That's just casting. Like, why? Like, I don't know. I just can't.
And I think an argument, I remember kind of reading a little bit about that. They may have been interviewing Christian Bale or someone else in the movie or working in the movie. They're like, oh, well, like, you know, if they're doing it because like Christian Bale and the other white dude are bigger names, so they'll draw more people in to see the movie, and like, yeah, they're, you know, they'll bring more capital there, which I don't think is a good argument for a lot of reasons, but the movie is reflecting reality, and which you could, like, there's not something, there's not black and brown actor or Arab actors as well that you can cast in these films,
yeah,
who maybe they're not as big as Christian Bale, but like, yeah, you can't do that.
Well, I mean, they do.
Yeah, they right. do. And I think one way to make a parallel between, you know, Black Lives Matter and just broader black liberation movement, especially in the past, you know, 10 years or so, and this is like, okay, what do we do about it? So they're doing this for money. They want to bring in more capital by bringing these bigger names and stuff. Like, how do we combat that? I was like, well, like, don't see the fucking movie. They're doing it so they're getting more money, then like, don't give them your money, right?
Yeah.
I remember having a conversation with my dad around the time the movie came out. My dad, like, he likes action movies. He likes, you know, high body counts, shit's exploding. He's a very intelligent, He's a very intelligent guy. Don't get me twisted, but like, when he goes to the movie, he wants to sit there, not think that much, be entertained. He wants shit to blow up and like leave, and that's it. Like, that's generally what he likes, right? And so he was like, you know, I think he was gonna see it, or maybe he wanted to see it. And I was like, Dad, don't see it. I was like, here's the thing. You want to see it? I don't care if your eyeballs feast on these white folks, you know, in blackface, but don't pay for it. Like, go get a ticket for like Madea or some shit, and then go see if you want to. Like, don't give them your money. So the point I was making earlier with like looking at black liberation movements now and, you know, looking at black representation or misrepresentation or no representation in art and media today is divest, right? So lots of campaigns going on now as well. BYP, Black Youth Project, 100, Black Lives Matter, Chicago, other groups, I'm sure other cities as well, have this campaigns to defund the police or defund, you know, have them where the money goes from the state and from other private entities, have the money go to education, to, you know, infrastructure, to mental health and social services, things that people need and use, and not, you know, the punitive measures like the police, right? So it's like defund the police, divest in, you know, Israel's thing a couple of years ago, and lots of these, like, we're like, looking at where the money goes, like the economic impacts of things, has been a very, I think, a very key, very smart, and very practical analysis in lots of these groups. I think Black Liberation uses that as an example, other groups do it as well. But same thing with media, right? Mm-hmm. So, like divest in whitewashing, right? Don't pay money to see Exodus, Gods and Kings, or that god-awful Gerald Butler version of the same fucking movie, right? Like, don't see them. Or, like, you want to see them, you really have to. Again, get a ticket to Madea.
Or some other film. There's countless of films coming out now.
Take it something else and then go watch it. Like, that's what you need to do, do it. But, like, divest. Divest in whitewashed media.
And right now, like, especially with the type of films that have been coming out, you know, you have movies like Dope. You have movies like Straight Outta Compton. You have movies like, what was the other one? Get Out, which I have yet to see.
I've told him many times.
It's interesting because, like, okay, so you have seen, and I've heard countless things about this film. You know, number one being that it grossed pretty fair, especially with this being for Jordan Peele's first, you know, big picture.
The first thing he directed, at least. He wasn't there at all.
It was interesting because you have people of all denominations going to see this film. You know, it wasn't just like black people going to see this film. And a lot of things for some people that I know, you know, kind of went over their head. But for a good majority of people, they kind of felt the layering of the film. And, you know, because you watched it, you think you can tell us a little bit about maybe one or two particular things that you kind of got out of that movie there?
Yeah, I mean, the movie was phenomenal. I'm sure everyone kind of knows, but it's a black guy who is dating a white woman in the city. They're dating for about 3 or 4 months, and so it's time to meet the parents, right? And so they go out to, not the country, but, you know, outside the city to...
Suburbs.
Yeah, it's vast suburbs. It's like, it? Yeah.
I mean,
it's like, not like
it.
Country,
remember,
but it's like...
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it. They go out of the city to visit, to meet the parents, for him to meet her parents. And he meets her parents, and, you know, there's kind of the racial undertones there. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, the black man dating a white woman. The parents are, like, center left, and they're very, like, liberal and open, all that good stuff. But then he notices the black people in the community acting really awkward and really weird. And then, you know, from then on, they have, like, a kind of a garden party type thing. And overt and kind of more coded racism ekes out, and then things go awry. I don't want to ruin anything for you. But that's the setup. But I think it was very much pitched as, like, a black man's horror film, right?
Yeah.
So, anyway, like it, the way, I mean, I've talked to multiple people about it, like, black folks, white folks, Latino friends, are just like a lot of different people, men, women, people who, you know, quote unquote woke, people are not woke, just, yeah. And everyone loves it for something like not different reasons, but for lots of reasons. And it's very layered, very, again, very, very nuanced, a very, sometimes in your face way of talking about things. My friend, Mr. Quinn Wilson, is also a filmmaker, very tall, lanky, post woke white dude, a good friend of mine.
Post woke.
We'll explain that later. So the garden party scene, it's like all these white folks come for this like thing they have every year, and, you know, he gets asked all these, like, you know, ignorant white questions, or it's all these things being said to him, and like, in they mean well, but it's also like, okay, you don't think that way, you don't say that to somebody. Again, I won't try to ruin anything for you, but you should see the movie. So Chris, the main character, the black guy, he's a photographer. He goes away from the party and talks to this other white dude, older white man who's blind, and he's also a photographer. And so he was. He runs an art gallery. And so he's talking to Chris about, you know, the other whites, so to speak, mm-hmm. and about how they don't, you know, they mean well, but they, you know, they don't get it. You need to watch the movie to see how that unravels, but it's very interesting to see, you know, this family, Rose's family, the woman that Chris is dating, and they're like this, you know, liberal, open, you know, would have voted for Obama a third term if they could, type of family and stuff, but still, you know, harbor these sentiments about, you know, people who don't look like them, which I think is very common. I think we're getting to that now in this political moment, but I think white people are feeling more implicated in knowing if they can, you know, they can do all these things to combat racism, but how, you know, the system still benefits them. So I think it gets to the implication of the white liberal,
yeah,
right? And this character within this space of well-to-do white people, he's like the most well-to-do, right? And he's like, oh, they don't get it, but like I get you, bro. You know, and Chris kind of, he's like, okay, cool. He kind of grapples onto him a little bit, but still, it's like there's still this thing where it's like you can be white and as anti-racist and as like woke as you want to be, and you can. That's great, but it's like you're still white, operating in white capitalism, and my relation to that is like, again, I'm black. But I'm also you know, a cis straight man, so like I feel, I'll ask my feminist women friends, like, would you consider me a feminist? Like, can I say I'm a feminist? Yeah. And most of them are like, yeah, of course. Like, you think women are equal? You know, you act to combat sexism. Woo, woo. And I'm like, you're right, I do. But it's like I can do as much as I can to be an anti-sexist, but like I'm still a man operating in like cis, like straight male hegemony, and I feel like I have problems saying like I am a feminist because, yeah, I think women are equal. I can. I think I'm like more keen to inequalities, gender, and what have you. But it's like I can do and read all the Audre Lorde I fucking want and do all these things,
yeah,
and be as, you know, quote unquote woke as I can on like gender issues. But it's like I'm still benefiting from being a man, and like I still harbor thoughts that I know
shouldn't be harbored.
But it's like I, you know, and that I can't help it, but still I still operate than a you know, a male straight hegemony. It's like, how do I don't know. It's hard for me to call myself like a feminist when like, well, I mean, I know I'm in this system.
Yeah, no, and kind of like off of that same sphere is like, I guess that's what Moonlight was able to do, and that's why Moonlight was such, you know, had such an impact, you know, because I know for myself, coming from a purely Latino background, you know, I'm from the West Side of Chicago, predominantly Mexican, predominantly first generations. And I think, you know, being from that background and having a lot of machismo being a thing, you know, and a lot of what religion pushes, or at least certain sects of Christianity, is, you know, male is the head of the household sort of attitude. And, you know, you don't say this because that makes you seem like a girl, and you don't want to seem like a girl because seeming like a girl makes you gay. And, you know, like, you know, the biggest thing, like, I remember a huge part, especially during high school, was like, hey, man, I love you, no homo. You know, like the whole no homo thing. It's just like, or you just, you know, you didn't do certain things because it's like, you don't want to be a fag. Like, hey, it's like, hey, why are you being gay? You know, it's just like, we laugh about it, but I think Moonlight was able to put it like right in our face. You know, they're having such an intimate moment that you have to recognize what it is. It's not something else, but, you know, that moment. And I think Ali's character, who is this, you know, badass guy who finds this little kid in a crack hole, basically, and then from there kind of takes him under his wing a little bit, and realizes that this kid is unique, you know, realizes that this kid is something different, and he's there in him. And even when, actually, I don't want to ruin the film, not that I think I'm going too much into it, but like, regardless, like, it's him and his girlfriend, I want to say, or are they married?
I don't know.
His partner. Yeah. Also, like, you know, it's the two of them kind of seeing this kid, because you also have, you know, his mom is a druggie, so she's not really even there for him, and she even to a degree, you know, feels things against him. So, you know, homosexuality as a thing, you know, bringing about into conversation, you know, I think it's necessary, and I think it was great. I know that my parents have not seen it, and I know you probably have the same sort of, you know, background where it was like, you know, you're a black dude, like, why you get that pussy shit away from
me? Hey, I'm straight though, no homo, all right? No homo though.
Actually, but you know what I want to shout out? I want to shout out to some of my brown folks who are in film. So I know everyone knows about Star Wars, and, you know, how they've been coming out with, you know, they're selling to Disney. And then I heard about 4 years ago, and I was like, what the fuck are they doing? No, to Disney, why? And then I seen Star Wars Episode 7, and I was like, oh, yeah. It was amazing. And I know the actor for Rogue One is actually Diego Luna, who I've actually seen in a Mexican soap opera. And yet he got one of the lead roles in Rogue One, which, by the way, if y'all haven't seen any of those, or y'all like, it's, oh, phenomenal. Star Wars sucks. Like, nah. Rogue One is probably their best Star Wars. That's just my humble opinion. But as for Star Wars Episode 7, it was actually Oscar Isaac. He's a Guatemalan actor who ended up being also in Star Wars. And, like, solid, yeah. You know, I think something that Star Wars has been able to do that we hadn't seen prior is, you know, is kind of jump on that, you know, diversity sort of bandwagon, if you will. But even then, I think it's very much necessary, because we don't see it in enough places. You know, not only are they putting, you know, Latinos in lead roles, they're also putting, you know, African-American, black. I know the gentleman who play John Boyegan, I think. He plays Finn, the black stormtrooper. You know, that's. I don't remember seeing another black guy in any Star Wars film.
Well, we have Lando Calrissian.
True. You do.
They were there. They existed, you do. But it's like,
and Jar Jar was played by that one guy. What's his
name? And there's Jar Jar problem. We could do a whole podcast on the
Jar Jar Binks.
Problemization of Jar Jar Binks. But I don't think anyone needs to hear that. Star Wars specifically, it's like, this is a galactic tale, and you got like all these different species and aliens that don't exist in real life, but it's like, there's like one black dude.
We're the brown people. Yes.
Y'all can have Negroes, but y'all gotta have some fucking, you can have Wookiees. Like, the fuck? Right? What is this?
Well, I do remember something that was pretty interesting. So when Star Wars was coming out and you kind of saw the trailer and knew that you had this stormtrooper who kind of comes to an awakening of some sort, and you happen to realize that the stormtrooper is black. I remember reading a couple things about, you know, what it meant that the storm, why was the stormtrooper black and like all this sort of thing. And I really appreciated Boyegin, by the way, I hope I'm not butchering your last name. His response, and he was like, I don't really care, was what he was saying. He's like, I'm British. And he's like, I'm a black British man, but I don't think that my color as being a stormtrooper or whatever position matters at all. And I think it's, we don't see that enough. We feel that a lot of times, or I see a lot of times that, you know, a person of color, when they're asked a particular question, they'll either shy away or they'll try to speak as politically correct as possible. But, you know, his sort of kind of like, I don't really give a fuck attitude about it was very much necessary. Our ladies out there, you know, having, you know, the lead role in both these last two films, it's been a growing. And now we have a woman Jedi, you know, being a badass and going to be trained by Obi-Wan. I'm really looking forward to this next one. I know it's going to be great.
You mean Luke?
Huh?
You mean Luke?
Yeah, the old guy.
No, yeah, Luke. Obi-Wan been dead.
Oh, see, I confuse my white people sometimes. I'm sorry. Sorry, y'all ain't the only ones to do it. We do it too.
He thinks y'all look the same. We just call them police and keep it moving.
That's so funny. To wrap this one up, is we see, you know, that black and brown are still being are making their way into more of the Hollywood, you know, light, and we're really trying to do our roles, you know. And as Colin has put it, you know, we wanna sort of speak with our money, you know. I think
I like that.
As, you know, how we support that representation of people of color, you know, is we can do it in multiple ways, you know. But like, why if someone asks you why is that important, Colin, you know, what would you tell them?
It's important because it reflects our social world, it reflects what reality is, and we all have stories that need to be told. On the mainstream level, there'll always be an indie and always be kind of a mezzo level as far as new media and culture and podcasts like this. But there needs to be representation, you know, racially, sexually, socioeconomic status, if you will. Just like everything needs to be represented, because that's how our social world operates, right? And I think that's what's one biggest reason why.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of brown and black folks have money now too, and like, and especially with movies and stuff. I think Jordan Peele made this point in actually a podcast I listened to like last week or so about Get Out. It was like, you know, black folks go to movies a lot. You know what I mean? Black folks go to horror movies too a lot.
Yeah,
and it's like if we're not even being shown or black sentiments in like getting the fuck out the house when you need to aren't being shown, it's like, why are we doing this? But it's like, now maybe you have more reason to do it now. Right. So it's like, talking to like the conservative old white man only cares about money, doesn't care about any of the social world looks like or any of that, anything else like they were preaching now, which is important. But if you're talking to that person, it's like, look, you want to make money? Well, you need to cater to these folks. They have money they want to spend on your product. But I think 2017 and moving on will look different, especially under Trump. I think will look different as far as where people who are underrepresented spend their money.
Yep.
Because they'll have options there. They're going to entertain them the same way that someone coming down from, you know, a big top tier media production company or what have you will. And it'll also be catering to them as people of color or as people who share the sentiments of that film, of that article, of that what have you. So
always support local, you know. So we're out here located in Chicago for anyone listening out in the further world. But wherever you're at, you know, you can, and it's not just film, you know, there's also theater, there's also music, you know, and we really need to understand how crucial it is and how important it is for us to be aware that we can make a difference. You know, we really can be what does that change, and it's on a daily basis. As J. Cole would say, change is slow, always has been, always will be, but fuck that. I'm a bust back till they kill me. Just facts. By the way, a shout out to our guy Genta Tamashiro and Miss Desiree Gladden. They're the ones who you probably hear on the outside. who helped make this thing possible for us.
They're listening to us just stammer and drink alcohol.
I mean,
trying to sound smart.
I mean, we're almost done with this. I can't believe we've been drinking as fast as we have been.
It's pretty smooth. It's like 35.
We're glad that you guys listened. We hope that you guys continue and check us out. Once again, it's soapboxpo.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay black, stay brown, stay queer. Good night. Back at it, craftmatic. All I know is mathematics. On the stove, cooking chicken, right? Rigid gymnastic. Acrobatic with the work. Like Houdini, do the magic. Me go bring me kilos. So I bust them squares up out the plastic. Get in traffic. Also, traffic.